Question number one. I have heard of many monastics who do not use nimitta as a means of attaining jhana. Please discuss. Also, don't nimittas reflect the characteristics of the meditation object? So light nimittas would arrive from kasina practice. No. So when you do kasina practice, it's what you do when you go to the casino. You put money on this, by the way. That's called kasina practice. But kasina practice is when you visualize the light. And then you get nimitta from the kasinas. But you also get it from breath meditation, loving kindness meditation. It's just natural. It's just what happens. And many monastics do not use nimitta as a means of attaining jhana. That you always have to go through that stage where all the five senses disappear and you stop thinking. I just was at the monastery this afternoon and some people say, no, you can still have thinking in jhana. No way. If you're thinking, you're not in jhana. If you can still feel the body, you're not in jhana. So, you know, sometimes what happens, we dumb down the jhanas. Because everybody wants to get jhanas these days. And Ajahn Brahm still keeps a very high standard. So people come and see me and it's so difficult. You have to do this and you have to do that. And you go to a monastic in the next monastery. Say, no. You can think that you can feel the body. Say, I'll go to that monk over there. It's much easier to get jhanas over there. It's just like you can get some degrees in US universities. Just send $25 or $100. You get a degree by the return of post. Yes, you've got a degree, but it's not worth very much. It's not the real thing. So, yes, a few people can slip into jhanas without the kasinas, without the nimittas, without the lights, but it's very uncertain. In other words, they're not really quite sure what they're doing. Which is why it's much better to develop the perception of that particular thing just before jhanas. Perceive it as a light. It is not seen with the eyes. It's felt with the mind. So sometimes that it's there, it's just how you interpret it. And developing the interpretation of these things as lights is really helpful. If you don't want to just get a jhana every now and again by chance, but you really want to be skilled at these things, use the lights. They're far, far better. Dear Ajahn, if there is no self, why do we get into samsara and get a mind and physical body in the first place? Because you believe there is a self. That's the problem. There ain't. But because you think there is, that's why you have the problems. It's your assumption, it's your delusion. It's the delusion which gets you reborn, not the truth. So because you think this is self, that's why you won't give all your money in the donation box. Can you do that? I once challenged people. Who will be able to give a blank check to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia? One person actually did that. They gave me a blank check. Just to the Buddhist Society of WA, they signed it, and just I could fill in any amount. You know what I did? I gave it back to them. It was just a test. I wouldn't do that. But I was really testing them to see just how much confidence and faith they have. Why are you bothered about it? It's not your money, is it? Is it yours when there's no self? What are you worried about? So it just shows the difference between experiencing no self and just believing in it. So there is no self. Yeah, I know, but I do like my little things here, my little things there. So that is the reason why we get reborn. That's the reason why we get attachments. We're attached to things because even though you may be in a Buddhist for many years, you know there's no self. In theory, yes. In practice, no. It's really weird that sometimes, that somebody dies, and it may be your mother or your sister, and you get upset. All those years of practicing, what's going on? We're all going to die. Why can't we let each other go? It's only your sister. It's only your husband. It's only your kid. What's the big problem? Because it's my child. Because it's my mother. because it's my sort of best friend. All the problems come when you put my before them. My. In other words, when it's attachment. And one of the great sayings of the Buddha, when I saw this brilliant saying, where there is a mine, there'll be a self behind it somewhere. Whenever there's attachment, it's because you have a sense of self, me. So that's how you can know whether you've got a sense of self left. If you own things, if you think it's yours. And that's why when things start to, all fear becomes, arises from something which you're attached to is being taken away from you. That's called fear. Something you're attached to, your mother, you're attached to them. They're being taken away from you. That's fear and that's suffering. Your own body is getting old. You're afraid. You're afraid you're getting old and ugly. Your beauty has been taken away from you. That's why you're afraid. You're afraid of the stock market crashing because your money has been taken away from you. And when you get into meditation, you're afraid of letting go of your body and letting the meditation deepen. You stop it because you're afraid. You're attached to your body and your five senses. You're afraid of letting go because you're attached to your will. So actually to go deep in meditation, you come to many barriers of fear. Every time you have a fear, that's where insight happens. That's where you find out what you're really attached to. That's where we get reborn. There's no self, that's true. But because you think there's a self, because that's your underlying psychological bent, you will have possessions, you will have attachments, you will have suffering, and you'll get reborn. You want to get reborn again? Do you really think you finished with school? Imagine having to do it all over again. Doing nappies all over again. Doing these pacifiers all over again. Do you want to do that? If you do, you will. If you've had enough, maybe you get out. I have heard of many monastics who don't... It's exactly the same. The people actually writing this saying, I have heard of many monastics who do not use nimitta. I have heard of many monastics who do not use nimitta as a means to attain jhana. Someone is a bit schizophrenic. They got dual personality, exactly the same. That's weird. So please, only do the same question once. Because I know I tell the same stories over and over again. But you don't have to do the same questions over and over again. Ajahn, can nimittas be coloured? I saw a beautiful electric blue light this afternoon. That's because you put your fingers in the electric socket. I don't know what you did. Yes, it could be any colour whatsoever. The colour is not important. What is important, simplicity, beauty, depth, if it really is a nimitta, one of the characteristic signs is it's a sort of blue or a pink or a mauve or a gold or whatever, which you can't really see in the real world. If it's white, it's really deep white. Never, you know, see a colour like this. It's like white, but it's deeper than any real white you can ever see in the world. So these are supernatural colours. Brilliance and wonderful. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is Jainism much different from Buddhism? Are there goals similar to Buddhism? Can attain nirvana? Do Jains practice meditation? Would love to hear your views and thoughts. Why? What's that got to do with meditation? Anyway, yeah, Jains, they were in the same time as the Buddha, but did they practice meditation? No. And where I get this from is from the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Citta Sanyutta, where Citta was a man, he was a very senior disciple of the Buddha. I think he was a householder, but he was very rich. And he went to see the leader of the Jains, and they were discussing meditation. And the Jain, leader of the Jains said, look, here's a disciple of the Buddha. You know, a very well-known disciple of the Buddha. Come on, you answer this question. Is it possible to stop thinking? Do you believe that? And this chitta said, no, I don't believe that. I don't believe it's possible to stop thinking. And then the leader of the Jain says, see, even a chief disciple of the Buddha knows you can't stop thinking. It's just like trying to stop the current of the river Ganges with your fist. You cannot do that. Thinking is natural. And then Chitta said, yeah, I don't believe it because I know it, because I get into jhanas. These disciples of the Buddha are sneaky. You can't have an ordinary conversation with them. That's really a funny sutta, because what he was saying there, I don't believe it, I know it because I experience it. And making a very important distinction between belief and knowledge. But what it also showed, that these leader of the Jains, the head guy, didn't really understand that you could actually stop all thinking and be silent. Didn't even know that degree of meditation. So that really showed that in the other traditions there was not really any meditation to speak of, which was interesting. So what the Jains did was to basically the law of karma, you got so much bad karma, the only way to stop being reborn is to use it all up. And the only way to use it all up is to torture yourself throughout the whole of your life, hoping that by the end of your life you'll actually have finished off all your bad karma and you won't need to get reborn again. So those Jains, they were really doing all sorts of practices like standing on one leg facing the sun all day long, now only eating just one grain of rice every few days. It's asceticism. And the Buddha said, no, no, we won't do that. So that was basically Jainism at that time. Burning off all karma by being ascetic. And not making any new bad karma. That's why the Jains would be very strict vegetarians. They wouldn't even walk on the ground without somebody sweeping in front of them to make sure they never even squashed any bug. And they'd wear cloth over their faces to make sure they never inhaled any bugs. Pretty tough. It's much more fun being a Buddhist. You can crack jokes, you can eat whatever you want, and you can actually sit on cushions. Very nice. So if you want to be a Jain, fine. But sometimes there was a lot of competition between the Buddhists and the Jains. And so sometimes, you know, the Buddhists, you know, they had to do things because they had to keep up with the Jainses. Oh, good, you got that joke. At last, I've got one you laughed at. Dear Ajahn Brahm, on the topic of superstitions, I love superstitions, traditions and rituals. Most religions I know of have some sort of icon which is revered. Don't you think it is time that these are put away? No, we need more icons. Don't you think you should have a statue of Ajahn Brahm here? No way. I know they're only symbolic, but are they not just another case of keeping conditioning active, whereby too many look to external factors to change and improve their lives? Look within, a great teacher once said. That's why sometimes you have a picture of the Buddha, a painting of the Buddha, or something, just have a mirror inside. So when you look at the Buddha, you just see yourself. That's interesting. But you have to be careful when you throw every tradition out. Sometimes they say the baby goes out with the bathwater. Having a Buddha statue, I think, is a great tradition. Keep that. But don't go wearing it around your neck to protect you from bullets. That's bad. Don't go, like, I'm not sure if I told you. I heard this, there's a few Indonesians here, you should know this. That those big stupas out there, they're actually, you know, from Borobudur. You know, from just the same stone as made this great monument in the middle of Java. And if you've ever been there, they have the same thing, beautiful Buddha statues inside the stone monument. And the superstition is, if you can climb up there and put your hand inside, and if you can touch the Buddha, you will find true love. That's a superstition, that's what it says. So, as soon as we put that, I told the monks, if ever I see any of you putting... You go to another monastery. And if ever I see any of you, and you're already married, I know who you are, putting your hand in there, I want true love. That's crazy. So having a Buddha statue like this is fine. And again, you may all know, I've been teaching this for a long time now, whenever I bow to the Buddha three times, I don't bow to that metal object, I bow to what it stands for. And what it stands for is virtue, peace and compassion. So I bow to virtue. When I bow to virtue, it means so much to me, being a good person, trustworthy, honest, restrained, so you don't take alcohol or other sort of bad drugs. That's such an important part of happiness in this world. It's very easy for me to bow to virtue and remind myself I must be a virtuous monk. Every time I bow, I remember that. Then I bow to peace, especially the stillness of meditation. That's just so important in life. I think it was, not Descartes, I remember it in a minute. He said, all the problems of mankind and womankind as well arise from not being able to sit still. Who was that again? I wrote about something. It's one of the French philosophers. All the problems of mankind and womankind come from not being able to sit still. Brilliant little observation, about 17th century. He said that. And so I really respect peace in all aspects. Peace between people, between nations, especially peace between your ears. So you're quiet and making peace with things. So I bow to peace. And then I bow to compassion, to kindness, to forgiveness, to letting go of things. Because that really is such a beautiful part of our world, just being kind. Kind to your body, kind to your mind, kind to your stupidity. Kind to the whole world, and forgiving, and accepting, and embracing. So when I bow to compassion, it means the compassion, I remind myself of its importance, so it grows stronger and stronger in me. So by doing those three bows to virtue, peace, and compassion, what the Buddha stands for, those qualities actually improve in me. It's not a superstition anymore. It's a spiritual practice which is incredibly effective. If I didn't have something to bow to, it would be very difficult to do that. So let's keep some of these rituals, and it really helps. Keep some of the respect for the Sangha. They're carrying on the tradition of the Buddha, both monks and nuns. Respect them. Respect your parents. Doesn't mean you do everything your parents say, but at least respect for parents is a very beautiful thing to see in our world. So this is not superstition. There's a reason for this. So a lot of the stuff in Buddhism, you don't have to have incense, that's why we don't have incense here. You don't need it, and it's just actually bad for your health. It's as bad as cigarette smoke. You don't need to have lights here. We've got those candles, but we don't light them. We've got electric lights. It's much easier. So there's many of those superstitions we don't really need. Those ones we can let go of. But the icons, just something simple, just like a Buddha like this, is good enough. Of course, sometimes there's so many Buddhas, just icon after icon after icon. And sometimes you spend all the money just building a big hall for the Buddha, and never a hall for the people. Never like huts for the nuns to stay in. And that's really wrong. So in monasteries, sometimes keep them practical, simple. So just comfortable so the monks and nuns, people can come and visit. But you don't need chandeliers and gold and all this other stuff. I must admit, superstition really goes overboard. I went to Medan last year, and there was the biggest temple in the whole of Southeast Asia. I couldn't believe just how huge it was. It was like a shopping mall. And it must have cost $1 billion or $2 billion US. And it was there for Maitreya the Buddha, for when Maitreya comes. It's just a total waste of money. That really was superstition. So please, please, don't do that sort of stuff. Or like they said the other day, superstition which is not Buddhism, but which is culture. About Chinese traditions, especially with funerals. But don't think that just Chinese are superstitious. Westerners are superstitious as well when you do funerals. Now I truncate the funerals. I was one of the first people in the whole of, certainly West Australia, I was the first, probably in Australia, who cracked a joke at a funeral service, told a funny story. And when I remember doing that, And the funeral directors at the back, all dressed in black, go, no, no. But I'm not going to follow them. I just told my joke. So, you know, that's breaking superstitions. And everybody loved that. So be careful of superstitions. Some of them, there's got some meaning behind it. Some of them haven't. If they haven't got the meaning behind it, you don't know it, then don't follow it. In Sri Lanka, the string around your wrist. Is that going to... I've seen many people in funeral services who had died and they had string around their wrist. It didn't work. So don't be so superstitious with this sort of stuff. What other superstitions have they got? Going to do chanting. And sometimes, please, Sri Lanka, where they do all night Pirit chanting. And I really couldn't believe this. The Buddha actually said, don't do this. It's in the Vinaya. But still the monks do this. They chant very, very slowly. And you know, the first time I heard this, please excuse me, I almost burst out laughing. I couldn't believe it. It was only out of respect for some very senior monks sitting next to me. But this is how they did Namo Tassa. And I'm not exaggerating. Namo. What are they doing that for? You know, when a Westerner says that and says, you know, sometimes you think, well, because it's always been done that way. Just because it's always been done that way doesn't make it right. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. So please, you know, if Buddhism is going to keep on going in our modern world, that superstition, maybe the old men and women might go there, the young people never go there. It doesn't make any sense, it doesn't work. And even just again the superstition, just saying the precepts without keeping them, that doesn't work. You've got to keep them. So don't just bow down. Just bow down to something which is important so it can increase the good qualities in your life. Buddhism is a huge source of great understanding. But when people just think it's superstition, they miss the whole point. Your emptiness. I realized today there was a monk, or at least I think he was, wearing a hoodie, cut exactly like your robe. Are monks going hip-hop? Thank you. As I say, it's just getting rid of superstition, just, you know, becoming part of our modern culture. Yeah, no, because sometimes it gets a bit cold here, and it's actually not getting warm today, but still they can have a little hood which they can put over their heads instead of a beanie. And it's, you know, it's cool. Actually, it's warm, it's not cool. P.S. I saw wild rabbits on my walk. Happy bunny meditation. Yeah, of course, there's all sorts of animals over here. I want to cultivate more joy and happiness in my life. I've started reflecting on my virtuous qualities and good deeds I've done. I'm also doing small things to help others on a retreat. Do you have other suggestions on how I can cultivate joy? What did the Buddha say on cultivating a joyous attitude? Excellent. Reflect on all the good things you have done. And all the bad things you have done, drop them. Write them on the piece of toilet paper and flush them away. And keep all the good things. If you have a photo album, if you have a bad photo, what do you do with it? You delete it. You take a photo and your finger's in the way or it's out of focus, delete it. You just keep the happy photos. And the happy photos of your life, you look at those and it gives you lots of joy and happiness. And all the bad photos of your life, your divorce, the time you got sick, the time you went to prison, the time you... All those things, delete them. Forget about them, for goodness sake. All the times you got cheated, all the times your boyfriend dumped you, all the times your wife nagged at you. Delete. Delete, 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 delete. And only keep the good ones, then you'll be happy. What do people do? All the happy memories, delete, 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 delete. And all the bad memories. I don't know why he said that to me, but I'm never going to get that. I'm not going to forgive him. He should never have done that. And you keep all the bad memories in you. No wonder you're miserable and depressed and suicidal and all that sort of stuff. So please don't do that. Keep the good memories. Look for happiness. There's plenty of happiness in this world. Remember generosity, your own and other people's generosity. Remember kindness, all the acts of kindness you've done. And don't just think in this retreat, oh, it's my turn to do the chores today. Even if it's not your turn, do them anyway. Just for fun. That's what I learned how to do. I know, as a Westerner, I thought, okay, you do it today, I do it tomorrow, we'll have a roster. And then I learned, no, it's actually much more fun pinching other people's duties. So sometimes it's their turn to do the sweeping, but I sweep for them. I love doing duties, serving. You get so much happiness. One time, it was the job of all the monks to carry the water, fill up all of the toilets and everything. And one day I got up early and did it all myself. And when all the monks came, the bell went, ha ha ha, you're too slow, I beat you. I did it. And that attitude was far better than saying, it's your turn, you do it. I did it yesterday, it's your turn today. That really sucks. That's really so selfish. You know, when we get joy in doing service, what a wonderful thing it is that you can serve this retreat just by looking after everybody. And if Bianca needs a bit more help, you know, it's not your turn today to help, but you just love doing it, just to serve. Just like all those people who bring food for you. They don't get paid for that. Why do they come all this way just to feed you? Have you ever thought about that? Just service. They just love doing something good. And I used to ask people, why do you come and do this? And they say, because we enjoy it. Exactly. So when you do service for others, you get a huge amount of joy. So don't just think, no, it's not my turn today. I washed up yesterday, it's your turn today. Nah, 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 nah. That's not going to get you anywhere in life. So see if you can just do the service. The rubbish needs to be cleaned up, just take it out. And see if you can do it first before anybody. And then it becomes like a competition. We like rush to do the jobs. And if you're too slow, sorry, I'll beat you. Ha 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 ha. That's how you cultivate happiness. Also, don't forget to laugh at my jokes. Why not? Even if it's a silly joke, you can still laugh. It doesn't hurt. May I know what the difference is between sharing of merit and transfer of merit? It's pretty much the same, so I wouldn't really make any difference there. When I stop my inner talking, different visions appear. Can you explain why? Because you've still got an active mind, so you're not talking, but the mind is still making visions. So, calm down, be still. And then all those visions become still. So just calm down, just be still, just wait for a while. Don't do anything, don't react. And soon everything becomes nice and peaceful. What happens when you stop typing on the computer? You get the vision. It's called the screensaver. But if you don't do anything, after a few seconds, the screensaver disappears. Just like the mind. Those visions are your screensaver. Shh, don't do anything. And the screensaver will disappear. Does that sound okay? Anyway, my hero. Ah, isn't that nice? They call me my hero. Why are some monks in the other tradition vegetarian? It's the reason why monks in the other tradition are vegetarian is because some of the monks in our tradition aren't. Need variety in life. Variety in life is good. Is that okay? It's a good answer. Because the vegetarian question just goes on and on and on and on. Ever since the time of the Buddha, when Devadatta wanted to be a vegetarian, hasn't stopped. So, what's more important than what goes into your mouth is what comes out of your mouth. You make what comes out of your mouth pure, and then I think you'll be doing well in life. Dear Ajahn, how do I improve my self-discipline? Thanks. Beat yourself? No, don't do that. How do you improve discipline? This is a story from the Chinese Art of War. The emperor had one general who had perfect discipline in the army. He wanted to find out from this general, how do you get perfect discipline in your arm, in your regiment? And he said, my soldiers always obey my orders because I only ever tell them to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow my orders. And a wonderful little statement. If I tell you what you want to do, then you'll always follow my orders. And then I'll have perfect discipline. But of course, you start looking deeper. And how can soldiers want to get up in the morning? How can they want to train hard? How can they want to go into battle knowing they may get killed or injured? And the answer is motivation. That general was such an amazing motivator that before the bell went early in the morning, the soldiers couldn't wait to get up. They were so highly motivated, patriotism, manliness or whatever, I don't know what, they really wanted to train and fight. So when the battle began, they were just waiting for the order. They wanted to go into battle. They were motivated. That is the secret of discipline. Motivation. So you motivate yourself. Not with a stick, but with a carrot. That's why you get up early and meditate. Well, a few of you. Because you're motivated. The bliss better than sex. You know, enlightenment, just incredible ecstasy, stillness, all these great health benefits. My job is to motivate you, then you want to meditate. But if I came in here with a big stick, if I had, what's it called, PA systems in all of your rooms, with monitors, you know, in the office, and I could see what each one of you, 60 cameras, and I'd say, Glenda, get up, you're sleeping. You're going to bed too early, and monitors also in the kitchen. You're eating too much food. Stop it, Henry. Would that be real discipline? Yeah, I mean, you get up early, and you wouldn't eat so much, and you wouldn't talk so much. But would that give you any peace? The answer is no. So motivation is the way to actually get discipline. So my job is to motivate you to want to meditate. So when the chance comes, you just can't help it, you just want to. And many of you got that, you've got some really nice meditation, you're enjoying yourself, so you can't get enough meditation. Many of you have been silent enough, you love being silent, you don't want to speak. So I haven't actually forced you, be silent. I've motivated you, you see the benefit in it. And that is always the best way of discipline. Motivation, because you understand the benefits. So you don't need to force yourself anymore. It just happens. Last night, I finally got to the end of your book, The Art of Disappearing. And you disappeared? No. Last night, I finally got to the end of your book, The Art of Disappearing. I was reading the part about death, etc., the part about death. You talk about good and bad karma, and the bit that stood out for me is that even if you do heaps of good things, you quote say, you never know which end of the good bad karma stick you will get. So are we in actual fact powerless beings? That's a simile of the Buddha. I toss up the stick, which end is it going to fall on? Even if one end is really heavy and the other end is light, every now and again it falls on the light end. So this is all your good karma and all your bad karma. Whichever end is heaviest, it's liable to go on that end. But not always, even if you do lots and lots and lots and lots of good karma. Really kind, really generous, really good. But you've got a tiny bit of bad karma. Sometimes, oops, it's fallen on the light end. But don't worry. Make lots and 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 lots of good karma. Make this end really heavy, the good karma end. The chances are you're going to get a good rebirth. But the point is, it's not certain. That's what makes samsara scary. So what you can do is increase your odds, which is what we do in life. Increase odds. And in the end, just get out of samsara. That's the best of all. Don't get reborn again. Otherwise, who knows? Dear Your Emptiness, in my country, when a lizard falls on your head accidentally, especially when it falls on your head, it's a bad omen that someone close to you will die in 1 or 2 days. In my family, sometimes that happens to be true. Is there something as a bad omen? No, it's a bad omen for the poor lizard. Probably hurt itself on your head. It's amazing all these superstitions you have, but it is actually true. When a lizard falls on someone's body, that someone will die in 1 or 2 days. Because there's so many people close to you. People die every day. So whenever you see a kangaroo, someone will die in Australia. So these are superstitions. It doesn't work. If you actually did the statistics, you know, get a scientist, a statistician, to see if there was any correlation between people, the lizards falling on people's heads, the close relations dying, and you'll find there'd be no correlation at all. So stop all that stupid superstition. Why Angulimana, serial killer, can be an arahat? Well, we can't even see Nimitta. Exactly. Because even though he was a serial killer, he met the Buddha. So that's one of the reasons why. And he had incredible faith. The reason why he was a serial killer, because he had faith in his stupid teacher who told him to do that. But when he met another teacher, the Buddha, he actually did what the Buddha said and became an arahat. So if you only follow the instructions, then it would work for you too. What was the Buddha mean he's saying, I've already stopped, when he met Angulimala? I mentioned that the other day about that little novice. Stop. Stop doing things. Stop wanting. Stop moving. Stop. When you stop, the whole world stops and disappears. So Angulimala was clever enough to stop and soon became an arahant. And I like to say that story because, look, sometimes people say, oh, can people these days become enlightened? And even serial killers can become enlightened. So if they can become enlightened, why not you? And I love saying that because sometimes people say, oh, maybe I haven't got enough good karma to be enlightened. Maybe because I'm like this and I'm like that, I can't become enlightened. Everybody in this room can become enlightened. If a serial killer can, so can you. So what do you have to do? Follow the instructions. I remember many times people get like a new microwave. They plug it in first and it goes bang. And then they read the instructions. Read the instruction first before plugging these things in. And now you've learned the instructions, now meditate and get enlightened and have an end of this. There's this person who I sit next to during meal times. Actually, we can actually find out actually who writes these questions. Because, you know, in your questionnaires at the end of this retreat, I can actually compare the handwriting. So I can find out exactly who writes which question. There's this person who I sit next to during meal times, and every time it's time to line up for food, she always has this, oh no, not rice and curry again, look. And it cracks me up. Is that me? And it cracks me up. I just want to say thank you to that person for making my meal time more enjoyable. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. At least it's something to eat. Many people in this world have got nothing to eat. So you're saying, oh, at least I've got some rice and curry. But it's true. I mean, some people like rice and curry. Some people like potatoes. Some people like bread. Some people like pasta. So just because you're a Buddhist monk doesn't mean you have to have rice and curry. So sometimes, you know, if I'm a Westerner, you like Western food. You have like Asian monks, they like Asian food. You have Chinese monks like Chinese food, Korean monks like Korean food, like kimchi. So sometimes don't just think, because look, I'm a Western, you know what I like. I gave so many talks. When I, after 7 years of rice and curry and frogs and stuff, disgusting food, I went to England to visit my family. And this is absolutely true story. I went into my mother's apartment, and there on the gas stove was the chip pan, which they made like potato chips, you know, they fry like French fries. And I remember that from, you know, before I left. Because in the English tradition, this pan you use for frying the chips, you never cleaned it, because that would take away the taste. You just add more oil into it. And so the outside and the inside was crusted with this golden stuff. Now for over 7 years, maybe about 10 years of stuff. And that made it really delicious. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, I'm going to get some chips from my mother. And when I went into the, because I thought that, when I went into that kitchen, my mother, without prompting, said, I've been meaning to throw this away for years. And in front of me, she threw it into the waste bin. That really hurt. So she made me rice and curry. And now the only time I got any chips on that first trip was I went to a Thai person's house. And they gave me chips. So be kind to your monks and nuns. Then you go to see Ajahn Wayama. She loves pizza. Well, get her some pizza, because it's really tough being a monk. You can't get what you want. So every now and again, you know, look after them. So anyway, especially Sri Lankans, because I told when I went over to, not this time, Toronto, a few years ago, you know, I think the monks said, look, Ajahn Pami likes Western food. So they made me shepherd's pie. And I thought, great, I can eat something today. And it was potato and Sri Lankan curry underneath. And the thing is, you know, you get your desires going. It's here, oh, it's shepherd's pie, and you get to the bottom, oh no, here we go again. That's the suffering of being a monk. Here we go. Whenever my boyfriend is feeling stressed or nervous, I just sit him down and do a bit of Reiki on his head. I've never understood what I'm doing. But intuitively, I seem to know exactly what I'm doing. He says I always go to exactly the spot he needs it, and I notice his head is either hot or busy with some sort of energy. Is this result simply from the act of loving kindness, or is this due to some other explanation? No, loving kindness, that's what it is. Because you care for your boyfriend, you can actually feel it and you can contact. That's if you really have loving kindness, then everything works. And you can heal. I just mentioned to someone earlier, when I used to be a kid in London, playing soccer in the streets, used to always go for these tackles, and just, it was like the bitumen or the stone pavement. And so I'd scrape the skin off my knees. And every time I'd do that, I always remember running off to my mummy. Mummy, mummy, I've hurt myself. And she'd kneel down and kiss it better. She'd just kiss it with all those germs in on an open wound. And it would always heal up, and just the act of kindness, you know, from your mother, took all the pain away. Every time, the pain disappeared. And that was actually what happened. So it's amazing. Just loving kindness is an incredibly powerful healer. Your emptiness. Have there been cases where people are too attracted to nimittas that they take a long time, a few days to come back? Thank you. No, to jhanas, yes. But nimittas, no, they're not that stable. If you get into the jhanas, they can stay a long time. One of those favorite... Okay, wasn't there a story about a monk who was so deep in meditation that lay people thought he was dead and burnt him, but he was unhurt? Yeah, I told that story the other day. The story I haven't told was of a monk, and there was a Vietnamese monk, Ajahn Sujata told me this story, but he won't tell me who this monk is, who came to teach a 9-day retreat, and... Before he gave the first talk on the Friday night, he meditated. I suppose it was supposed to be half an hour. After half an hour meditation was finished, he was still meditating. And people just waiting for him to come out for the talk. After another hour gone past, an hour and a half, what did you guys do? You just went to bed. So they left him there. No talk that night. And they got up in the morning, he was still meditating, hadn't moved. He stayed in that same position, not going to the toilet, not doing anything, for about 8 days. Didn't move. So people would come in there, they get naturally no instructions, no interviews, no talks. And he just was there all the time, just like the Buddha statue. Didn't move at all for 8 days. And afterwards, he came out of meditation and said, I apologize. I just went into a very deep meditation. I'm sorry I didn't give you any talks. And everyone said, no, that was one of the most amazing things we've ever seen. It's wonderful to see that still possible today. But that's what he did. So it is possible. Ajahn, during dhāna, are monks actually allowed to take their own food or choose their food? What if there's a table of food served in front of you, like when you come to a family's home for a meal? Do they have to put everything on your plate, or can you help yourself? Thank you. In the old days, we'd allow people to put everything in the bowl. It was a big mess. And that's what we used to do. Every person, we took a spoon of this and a spoon of that. And look, it's just like, you know, like the Sri Lankans and the Tamils don't get on. Cambodians and the Thais don't get on. And so if you add the different foods, they don't get on either. And cause your tummy ache. And I used to have so many tummy aches because of so much food. It was just all different stuff. And it all go in the same bowl. You know, the curry and the ice cream would go on top of the curry. You know, the custard would go on top of spaghetti. And yeah, I mean, I've been there, I've done that. But after a while you think, that's not really good for your health. So after that we decided, no. Like in Bodhinyana Monastery, if you go there, the monks actually, we have the table all offered and the monks can just pick what they want from that. And it's much healthier. So that's what I do even here. Because if I take all the food there, it will really make me sick. I won't be able to teach you. So I just choose a little bit what I need. So they are allowed to take. And if you think that's being soft, I challenge you tomorrow to get a big bowl and take a spoon of everything which comes. I mean everything. And including, like we had ice cream today, the ice cream and everything else, and put it all on top and eat it. And then you know what it's like to be a monk. Okay, that's what you can do. What are ghosts? Are they beings like Peter, Ashur, Yaka, any others? If they exist in different planes, how do they show themselves to other human beings sometimes, or even teasing humans? Is it true they'll get angry if we humans inhabit their homes, such as trees or room, etc.? The ghost. Shall we have another ghost story? Now enough ghost stories. We have lots of time. Ghosts are just departed beings. They are low. Sorry, ghost got my nose. They are lower beings. So they haven't got much power. All they can do is scare you. But if you realize what ghosts actually are, you have much more power than they do. So you can just go boo to them and they will run away. Well, that's really true. The first time I started seeing ghosts, they ran away from me. It's a really weird thing. What, you can see us? Ah! They ran. And I learned from that, and it's obvious, human beings are much higher than ghosts. So you have more power. It's very similar to the elephant and the mouse. The elephant is afraid of the tiny mouse. Who's got the most power? Of course the elephant has. The elephant could just stamp on the mouse and squash it. But the elephant is afraid of mice, just like you are afraid of ghosts. Tiny little beings, as far as power is concerned, but you're afraid of them. So if you ever see a ghost, scold the ghost. Listen, I'm meditating. Get out. If you don't show any fear, the ghost will have to depart. All they can do is teach you, that's all. And if you're not scared, they'll go to the person in the next room in your cottage and scare them instead. So you're pretty safe. Ghosts can't do any harm. I read somewhere that there are three meanings, three or how many I forget, of dreams. One of them is that when you dream a certain dream at night, it is a bad precaution and it means something. Is it true? If it is true, is there any examples of bad dreams which mean bad precautions? And how to differentiate between a bad precaution dream and the no meaning dream? Look, most dreams are not premonitions. They're not going to tell you what's going to happen. It's very rare to have a dream that is an omen. But sometimes it happens. Did I tell you the story of the man who dreamed of the five angels? Some of you know that story, it's in a book. A man dreamt of five angels. And every angel gave him five pots of gold, worth a fortune. And then he woke up, it was one of those dreams you get just before you wake up. So he remembered everything. He looked around the room to see if there was any angels. No angels, but even worse, no gold. It was just a dream. And when he went to have his breakfast, he saw that his wife had made him five pieces of toast and five boiled eggs. He looked at the newspaper. It was the 5th day of May, the 5th month. This was an omen. He looked at the back of the newspaper, the horse racing. Here in Perth is a horse racing called Ascot, named after a big one in England. A-S-C-O-T, 5 letters. He looked at race number 5 that afternoon. And he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw that horse number 5 in race number 5 was called Five Angels. You only have these omens once, if at all, in your life. So he took the afternoon off work. He went to the bank at lunchtime and took out $5,000 to keep the lucky number 5. He went to the racetrack. He chose the 5th bookmaker, the one who takes the bets, in the line. And he put $5,000 to win on horse number 5, race number 5, 5 angels. He knew because of the dream the number 5 could not be wrong. And it wasn't wrong. His horse came in 5th. Which is one of the trouble with omens. We only understand what they mean afterwards, when it's too late. So don't believe in your dreams. Forget the white light, nimittas, that you so often talk about. I get purple light. I've always thought this was the colour of the third eye. What are your thoughts on this? Having 2 eyes is enough. You don't need a third one. So it's not the third eye, but it's not just white light. Purple light is a good one. Blue light is very common. Gold light is very common. It really doesn't matter what colour it is, as long as it's beautiful. Purple is fine. Dear Your Emptiness, I appreciate the thoughtfulness in creating this beautiful retreat centre. I can turn off the light from my bed, a flushing sit-down toilet, plenty of coat hangers, etc., etc. But, could I offer some feedback for even happier retreatments? A coffee machine with barista to ensure the perfect latte. And perhaps you could set up a frequent meditations card, and we could upgrade to have our own club room, guaranteed quiet and foot massages. Some people have been to too many hotels. But a barista coffee machine in every hut? No, why not? Next time, we have a rule in Bodhinyana Monastery on opposite side of the road. Whoever has an idea has to do it. So whoever had the idea that every room should have a coffee machine, you should donate them. Now, Daddy said no to coffee machines, but now she said yes. Or just have it in the teacher's cottage. You can always make it more beautiful. Dear Ajahn Hee-Hee-Hee, your hee-hee-hee make it extremely easy to start the day. My question, how can we be compassionate and eat the being at the same time? Are you talking about eating meat? Because when they're meat, they're not being anymore, they're dead. You're not eating being. I don't mean. Oh, do you mean beans? Eat beans. Beans? Beans? Baked beans? I don't know. What is your favourite Buddha's disciple at the time of the Buddha? What's the favourite Buddha's disciple at the time of the Buddha? Anuruddha was really nice. He was the one who would just meditate and meditate and meditate and meditate. And it took him, was it 17 years to even become a stream winner? He was a great monk. So I think it shows you just, you don't, can't expect to get enlightened straight away. Even the great monks took years and years and years to become enlightened. Last question. Dear Ajahn, I do not observe the precepts on the Poya days, but I follow the precepts. Do you need to observe the precepts to become a successful meditator? No, it's not observing the one, it's actually taking them. Again, I mean, that is, again, superstition, just taking them. As long as you keep them, that's the most important. My own experience, you know, being a Buddhist in London, and I started meditating first of all before I started keeping precepts. And then just I thought, it's a waste of time, you know, killing things. And so, you know, I did become a vegetarian. And, you know, sometimes as a young man, if when you get on a bus in London, if the conductor never asks for the ticket or never asks for the payment, I thought, well, why should I pay? It's his fault, he never asked. But that was stealing. So after a while, even if the conductor never asked for the fare, I'd still pay. You know, I'd still offer it. You forgot to ask for my fare. Because I didn't feel comfortable with actually taking something which was not given. And of course, you know, I was always had just one girlfriend at a time, not two. That was enough suffering, having one girlfriend. So I never was actually committing sort of that adultery. And I started being very honest. It was wonderful being honest because people would actually trust you. And of course, the last thing I did was actually give up drinking alcohol. Now, and that was actually when I was a student at Cambridge. Because I was a scholar there, it was scholarships all the way for me because I couldn't afford to go there any other way. So every year at the college I went to, there was a scholar's dinner. And you couldn't believe, this was supposed to be at a cultured college in Cambridge University in England. We started off with sherry served by butlers. I mean, these were really well-trained English butlers in the gallery designed by Sir Christopher Wren around this huge mahogany table. Now, I was studying science and mathematical science, and the butlers were going around the table in a clockwise direction, serving sherry. So me and my mate, my friend, who also studying maths, we worked out, if we go at the same speed in an anti-clockwise direction, that means we will meet the butler twice each circuit rather than once, thereby getting twice as much sherry as our friends. That's what you do when you're a stupid student, see how much you can get. And having had, I don't know how many glasses of sherry, then we sat down for this 9-course meal. And every course had a different wine. Really, you know, high quality stuff. And after the 9-course meal, then we went to the old library, the third room, where we had three big, you know, crystal glasses. One was filled with port, one with Madeira, and one with claret. And then a mug came down, this big, you know, about this size, silver, encrusted with jewels. And it must have been worth a fortune. It's one of those heirlooms. And it had to be filled with claret. Now, this wine. And every student, not just the students, the professors, there was one of these guys who was a Nobel laureate in chemistry. And everyone, even the Nobel laureate, had to drain the whole thing and say a toast in Latin. You know, by that time, even if you knew Latin, you couldn't understand the slurred words. And that was supposed to be a good night out. And, you know, afterwards it took me 2 days to recover from the headache. And that was supposed to be fun. That was the last time I drank any alcohol. It was absolutely ridiculous. And all that nice food, which people, 9-course meal, I vomited it all out. It was stupid and it was disgusting. Why do people do that? And these are supposed to be intelligent people. And from that on, that's the last time I drank alcohol. Gave it up. It didn't make any sense. So, then I went to the temple. I used to go to the Thai temple. And I've been going there for many weeks, and one of the Thai monks came up to me and said, "It's about time you took the five precepts." I said, "What are the five precepts?" He said, "Not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol." And I said, "Sir, I'm already keeping them. Thank you very much. Bye-bye." He said, "Well, why do you have to say them if you're keeping them? It's more important to keep them than to say them." So that's why that so often that's one of the rituals and superstitions we don't do here. I never gave you the eight precepts or the five precepts when we started this retreat. Very rarely do I do that, because you don't need to. I want you to keep them, not just keep saying them, which is much more important. So unfortunately, in some places, the ritual, the chanting is all they do, and they never even listen to what it means. So that's why doing is more important than saying. So we try and keep the precepts, rather than just saying them. So there you are, that's the questions for tonight. So hopefully you enjoyed those questions. Are you turning off the thing already? So please have a wonderful night. Just to tie in the last little story, to tie in about keeping the precepts and also about ghosts. I like to actually give a warning, because you said about ghosts. There is one ghost which is dangerous. Wherever I go in the world, I like to warn people about this ghost. This is no joke, but it is a sort of joke, but it's true. I've seen this ghost possess people. I've seen it. And you know they're possessed when they act totally out of character. They're not themselves. They speak in a very, very strange voice. And I've even seen, unfortunately, kill people. I've seen many people dead because of when they get possessed by this ghost. It's called in Thai, the translation is, the bottle ghost. It's called the bottle ghost. It possesses people and makes them say strange things. It lives in bottles of whiskey, port, claret, Madeira, rum, vodka. When you open the bottle, it possesses you. You start to speak in very strange ways. And if you drive a car, it can kill you. That's why we call whiskey and rum and vodka spirits. It's called a bottle ghost. And that one really exists. I've seen it, you've seen it as well. So if you're scared of any ghost, please be scared of the bottle ghost. That one exists, and that one is dangerous. So good night, and be careful. I told you there's no ghosts in this place. There's no bottle ghosts. So you're perfectly safe. Have a nice night.